but at the moment, nothing directly within our program has been offered for the 2021 period.
Part two.
Great, thanks, Tyrell. Anyone else have questions? Hearing none, I yield the floor back to you, Brooke.
Alan, are you there? I can't hear.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, sorry.
Yep, the floor is yours. I think, is Mary next?
Yeah, Mary. Yeah, I'm going to turn it now over to Mary Burgard, our vote rehab supervisor, for program update. Mary?
Good morning, everyone. First, I'll start with some of our updates. We did hire a new rehabilitation technologist who started in March, and she's going to be reporting to the southern part of the state. She's going to be reporting to Stratford and covering the southwest, like Fairfield County, New Haven County, working with individuals down in that area. So that's actually kind of new for us. We have not had a rehab technologist down in that part of the state. Most of our technologists have reported to Windsor, so we're really happy to have her. She's actually already been out in the field working with people and really kind of hit the ground running. So we're thrilled about that. Barry Rita, as many of you know, retired as of June 1st. He was our transition coordinator. So we are in the process of refilling his position. We've gotten approval to refill it, but it should be going out for posting shortly. We are also in the process of hiring a VR counselor for the New Haven region, South Central region. So we've been down one for a number of months when Charlotta Copenhaver took over the position of transition counselor back in the fall. It's taken a little while to get the position refilled, but we are moving along, and we are planning on interviewing quite a few candidates next week, so hopefully that position will be filled soon. And as I think I reported at some point, we had also hired a transition counselor also back in September, Stacy Lewis, who was covering the other part of the transition case. So she's northern, Charlotta is southern, so she's kind of jumped into that position and is, you know, hit the ground running as well. So that's pretty much it as far as staffing. We have up until, well, just as everybody else, have been working pretty much 100% telework. We have opened up, as the rest of the state, pretty much in the agency, being able to go in person as of June 1st. We've always kind of had the ability to do that with approval and some criteria. We hadn't done that much over the course of the year. We have since June 1st had a bunch of staff going out, you know, seeing individuals again. And as Tyrell said, July 1st, we are working on 50% of the staff going back to the 50% of their time going back to the office. So everybody's going back to the office, but 50% of the time. So going forward, we're going to probably be doing a lot of hybrid, you know, going out in the field, virtual. A lot of things continue to be virtual, even though we'll be going back to the office. The world hasn't necessarily jumped on board yet, so a lot of things continue to be virtual. So that we're working on that plan right now. But over the last few months, one of our biggest focuses have been to purchase laptops for individuals who did not have access to them to be able to participate in virtual programs, whether it be a virtual training program, whether they need it for their work, that their employer was not providing it for them, whatever the reason, we've been focusing on making sure individuals get their a computer, a laptop, whatever they need with the assistive technology on it. To date, we have purchased 15 computers in the last few months, so we really kind of went full strong on that. So our clients have been participating in many different online programs. The American Job Center has offered many of their certificate programs as well as their job search programs online. Just to give an example, some of the programs are that Community Healthcare Program, Platform to Employment, Recovery Work Grant, ESL classes are just an example of some of the programs our clients have participated in at the American Job Center, along with many others. It's been a while since I've given the report, so I'm going to try to kind of summarize it rather than give you details of everything everybody's been doing. Going forward, in the past, actually, I should say, a few of our clients have participated in some of the personal adjustment programs, the Carroll Center, the LEAP program in Vermont, World Services for the Blind are all online. Perkins, we've all participated, we've had clients participate in all of those programs online, and it's been very successful. Some of those programs are starting to open up. So we have three of our clients scheduled to go in person to the Carroll Center this summer, and we have an individual going to World Services for the Blind in Arkansas. A lot of the programs, World Services for the Blind being one of them, are giving out scholarships where they're flying our individuals out there to be able to kind of save on costs and different things. So one of our clients was able to get a scholarship to get flown out there to participate in this program. Some of the other summer programs individuals are participating is LEAP in Vermont, which is still virtual. We have about 10 of our pre-employment transition students, transition students participating in that program. We had five of our transition students participate in that program over the spring. So they've been pretty much going all year long with different work-based learning experience. The summer program offers some paid online virtual work experiences, which is going to be great. As we're going into the kind of the world opening up, we're starting to see a little bit more of our opportunities for trial work experiences and internships starting to increase. Obviously, during the course of the last year, it's been really slow in that department. So now people are able to get out there. The restaurant industries are really looking for individuals, and Amazon has always been a huge employer now, especially now. So we have quite a few individuals employed there, but the hospitality industry, as you hear from Tyrell, but it's true in all of that industry, had really, really took a hit over the last year, and now we're starting to see a lot of those jobs opening up, so giving a lot more opportunities for some of our clients. We have done a few trainings. That's been one of the nice things about being virtual, is that we've been able to do a lot more meetings nationally, in particular for Voc Rehab, being able to send a lot of our staff to be able to participate in these national conferences and national meetings, being funded from the Rehab Service Administration, and CSAVR is national, that all of these, agencies throughout the United States have created community of practices and different conferences that we've had a lot of our staff be able to participate in, which has been really beneficial, from CSAVR to NCSAB. They're all national. Sorry, my calendar just clicked on something. So we've been able to participate in a lot of national conferences that we haven't been able to participate in the past, which has been really one of the perks, I would say, of COVID, if there are any, that was one of them. We have been able to easily have a lot of presentations come into our staff meetings. So we've had a lot of virtual staff meetings. We've had DMIS come in and talk about services. We've had the AJC reentry program recently come in and talk to staff. So we've done a lot of that. Our staff continue to participate in meetings that they had participated in the past, such as the business service team meetings through the American Job Centers, the Job Developer Leadership Network group, which is providers throughout the state. In different regions, have monthly meetings. One actually next week is actually starting to go in person. We have a couple staff going. They they had the staff meeting actually at a beach, Silver Sands Beach in Milford, the state beach. Because there's no fee to park anymore, so they're doing the meeting on a beach, which I thought was kind of neat. So we have a couple of our staff participating to that. So a lot of these meetings are starting to become creative to try to do these outside as much as possible. A couple other events that we've done is before Barry left, he did 3 mentor events that had about 10 participants each, where we had 3 mentors speak to some of our college students and some of our adults looking to get into certain careers, participated in the call to hear what individuals are doing, where they were working. Charlotta, one of our transition counselors, did 3 college events where individuals heard about the college process, the financial process, and different aspects of going into college. We have an individual coming on June 29th from UConn's from the Extension Financial Education Program. We have an individual coming to talk to, I think 20 of our clients are registered to talk about how to keep yourself from, being scammed or to protect yourself financially, basically financial literacy presentation coming up in June. So that's pretty much it for Voc Rehab.
Any questions for Mary? While I'm waiting, I do have a question for you, Mary.
Okay.
How do you find that the clients, the Voc Rehab clients, have adapted to effectively living online for the past almost 16 months now? Do you find that you've had a higher level of participation? Have people been able to gain access to the services they've needed without too much trouble? Have you even seen more people participate because they're able to do so on the interwebs?
Yes, I would say the first thing is transportation is always a big issue for individuals who are legally blind for obvious reasons, having to rely on public transportation and get to places. So being able to offer these programs virtually has been really beneficial for our clients. And I believe that, to answer your question, there's probably been a lot more participation. Like I said, the LEAP program, I can't remember the last time. That's actually a program out of Vermont that's like a work-based learning program. It's kind of designed for individuals who are transitioning out of high school to college. And there's been some college students who have participated in as well. We've even had some kind of young adults, not in either college or high school, participate. You don't have to necessarily be pre-eds eligible. But we've had, we have 10 people going to that program this summer, and I don't know that we would have had such a high participation if they had to travel to Vermont and go in person. So a lot of our clients have really embraced working virtually. I think if there were technical issues, our staff have been pretty good about assisting with that. It doesn't necessarily always have to be on Teams. It doesn't have to be on Zoom. It could just be a call or FaceTime, or whatever it may be. So I think our staff have had a pretty easy time. And again, a lot of people are home, so they're easier to get in touch with if they are working, to be able to have appointments. So yeah, there's been a lot of benefits to it, with the negative being the lack of opportunities for individuals to do assessments, to do internships, because not many people were hiring at all, but they weren't going to be hiring individuals temporarily because there were so many people out of work that they were not able to say, I'm going to take on somebody for 2 weeks and see how you do and potentially hire you. So those services just plummeted over the last year. So most new jobs that were virtual were more difficult, but many of our clients kept their jobs and were able to do virtual work, in their current employment pre-COVID. And some of them are staying that way or doing hybrid. So that's been a perk. With for sure transportation being the number one reason. It is definitely a benefit for our clients to not have to rely on public transportation to get into these meetings and, participate in certificate programs. And I do know a lot are going to keep the hybrid model. The American Job Centers are opening a lot of in-person, but I believe they're still keeping the online. So I don't know what the future will be regarding those programs. The Carroll Center, like I said, opened up, so I don't know, how long they're going to be offering the virtual programs. But so, yeah, the long answer to your question is yes. I believe there's been a lot more participation in training programs and being able to connect with individuals.
That's excellent. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to continue that in some hybrid fashion in the future, because it is still very important that we have people have opportunities for in-person contact with one another, because we are, after all, social beings. And I'm also pleased that staff have been able to attend national meetings, because I think it's very important that we are able to interact with people from other jurisdictions so that we can share information and also see how the other does business, and that we can learn from one another. So I'm hopeful that the lessons we've learned from living in a virtual world for the last year will continue to be applied, because I think this has really been, in some ways, a big step forward for clientele. So I'm very happy about that. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you. Yeah, and one thing I did forget to add, which is kind of important as well, related to that, is that we have done a lot of outreach as well this past 6 months, just to re-engage individuals who had been working pre-COVID that were not active in our program. And that was actually also a very beneficial, recruitment, just to be able to call people and say, how are you doing on your job? Are you now virtual? Do you need anything? And we opened many clients that, would not have called us because maybe their counselor had changed. So that was definitely also a beneficial activity that we've done in the last 6 months, being able to reconnect with individuals who were not part of the program anymore. And now they are, and they're getting what they need in order to keep their job successfully.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other questions for Mary?
This is Eileen Akers with a question and concern. I think I'm unmuted, right?
You are, yep.
Okay, good. If a person who is blind is going to an in-person interview, my concern is that the prospective employer is afraid or hesitant to ask very relevant questions, being concerned that these could be interpreted as being prejudicial or intrusive, or they just would not be comfortable asking some very necessary questions. On that basis, do the VR counselors ever go out and kind of warm up the employer, or maybe having a pre-interview session so that some of the misconceptions or concerns could be erased or somehow addressed before the actual prospective employee would be interviewed by the prospective employer? I've heard of a case where the VR counselor recommended to a client having an interview with an employer, but it didn't work well because of the hesitancy on the part of the prospective employer to ask relevant questions.
Yeah, that definitely a big part of a Voc Rehab counselor's job is to do employer outreach and employer engagement. Yeah, that's a big part of what they do, really. Almost probably 50% of their job is designed to do that, and do that employer outreach. We also contract that out with community rehab providers throughout the state. So when we do contract that out, those agencies have job developers that will also do that. And we do work with the CRPs to help train regarding, you know, blindness-related issues specifically, you know, because the CRPs do work with BRS as well. So, you know, our counselors really do spend a lot of time working with the job developers of those agencies to talk about blindness-related, you know, issues or barriers that we can help kind of, you know, put to rest, you know, for employers. So, yeah, there's a lot of training that goes into our counselors and a lot that our counselors do for that. Some of our clients, however, do choose not to have that option. So a lot of it really does depend on the person and whether they're comfortable or not. Because then we get into the whole disclosure versus non-disclosure, when you disclose, how you disclose. There's so many different strategies that go into play regarding everybody, and it's all individual. That's like such a general question, but yes. And sometimes employers are not necessarily forthcoming with a lot of, you know, concerns or questions or whatever it may be. So it just depends on the employer. It depends on the person. So, and there's no.
So then, Mary, it would be appropriate if say a client received If a client received the name of a prospective employer from a rehab, a VR counselor, the client could ask the VR counselor if they had done any outreach to that employer beforehand.
Definitely. And I mean, I would hope that the counselor would tell that person if they were going to send a job opening and they had interaction with that employer, that they would actually tell the person that prior to or at the same time of sending it to them. So I assume that there would be some sort of dialogue. But if sometimes what we do is we'll send job postings because we get so many of them, myself included. We're just on so many different lists, so we get a lot of job openings coming through the state. So sometimes our staff will just forward it to an individual, and then that individual will say, "This is a job I want to apply to," and then that dialogue happens. But sometimes it's just, "Hey, here's some jobs. If you're interested, let me know," and then they start the process.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Along those lines, Mary, and I beg your indulgence for a moment here on this, because I have noticed a trend. I'm trained as a land use planner, and many municipalities and even regional planning agencies that post openings for land use planners, I find, are now requiring driver's licenses. And when I was working as a technician, I found that I was able to work my way around that requirement. I don't expect an answer right now. It's just something to keep in the back of your mind. But I think that would be a concern that might dissuade somebody who wants to get into my particular profession or some other profession where people have the mistaken belief that if you don't have a driver's license, you can't participate and contribute when that is not necessarily true. So I think there's some education that may need to be done with employers, and there's some uncertainty as to whether they can actually make that a requirement, especially if a prospective employee can demonstrate that that is not an impediment to their performance.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that comes up a lot with the social work field, you know, and that is something that we have to work around a lot because a lot of the postings say driver's license required, but there may be an opportunity to work around that, like you said. Really kind of the rule of thumb is if an individual can do 80% of that job without driving, then it's an appropriate job. If the job is, you know, primarily driving, then that might not be you know, an appropriate job. Like, for example, we just happened to have two individuals come in that are were forklift drivers before they became blind. They don't work at the same place. They just happen to have the same job, you know. And that's a difficult job, obviously, to do because you're primarily driving and they can no longer drive. So they have to work on finding another job within that company or turn, you know, work around what type of job they're going to end up doing, you know, at that company. So, yeah, it really just depends on the level of driving that the person has to do. And unfortunately, you know, like, say you wanted to apply to become a truck driver, that's probably not a good job to apply to because it's 100% driving. So that's the way we look at it. You know, like you said, if it has a requirement, it's not a primary requirement, and it's only a small piece and they can work around that in the company, they often do. We've had many people get jobs that they are able to work around.
That's very encouraging, Mary. Thank you. I keep the 80% standard in mind because I think that's very valuable. So thanks for that.
No problem.
Any further questions for Mary? Hearing none, Brian, I yield the floor back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a kind of a check-in point, because we do have interpreters on the call until noon, and once we lose the interpreters, we meeting would need to end. So we're at the halfway point, the 11 o'clock mark. So I think we're doing fine with time, but I just wanted to give that status. In terms of the reopen plan and the COVID-19 updates, you've heard some of that from Tyrell and Mary, and I'll just affirm that right now, as of June 1st, per the governor's instructions, we have resumed what they refer to as forward-facing services, what I would call our client services. We do have staff that are going into the field and providing services to clients in the field. As of July 1, the building will reopen for occupancy of staff. There will be some restrictions around that. You've already heard that about the 50% telework. So on any given day, we're going to strive to keep the building population at no more than 50% of the staffing levels. Visitors can come to the building for meetings, but we certainly will encourage and prefer to utilize the lessons we've learned for virtual services for all of our interactions, meaning that if something has been successfully delivered virtually for the last year and a quarter, I don't see any reason that we would have to stop that. I've already, you know, told staff, for instance, that our staff meetings that we've been holding have been virtual, and I don't see any value in asking staff to drive long distances sometimes to come to a short meeting when that meeting could be held virtually and people could then have that extra time freed up to do other activities. And the same would go for our direct services staff. To the extent that a meeting can be successfully accomplished virtually and there's no compromise to the service that needs to be provided by providing it virtually, we're going to continue to employ all the lessons we've successfully learned. Mary Burgard mentioned some virtual camps where in the past there would have not really been a possibility to get some of these students to those camps because they were in other states, but these camps are being done virtually and successfully, so very positive feedback. So for students that want to go to virtual camps, we're certainly not going to take away that option. We feel that's a good option for those that want to go in person. Is again, Mary indicated, there are students that are also going to camps in person. Masking will be a requirement when people come to the building. Anyone who, for whatever reason, is unable to wear a mask, we can meet with them outdoors or we can meet with them in the lobby with social distancing employed. But even for staff who have been vaccinated, when you enter the building, you will have to wear a mask until you get to your work area where you're alone. And when you then move around the building, you would need to be masked. So we are following Department of Administrative Services instructions in that regard on how we are going to be handling certain aspects of staff within the building and visitors to the building. I'm also in the process of preparing an update to the in-person services protocols. That had been previously distributed by me back in September, which instructed staff as well as the providers who work with individuals that are deafblind how to go about safe interactions, certainly with the new guidelines that we have, not only through the Center for Disease Control, but also through the Department of Administrative Services. I've been incorporating their updates into this draft. I've just received from the leadership team at BESB their perspectives on the draft, and I'm going to be now circulating it to the members of the Deafblind Advisory Committee, give them an opportunity to review it before I finalize it and issue it out. But it certainly takes into account safety for staff, safety for clients, but it does also factor in the updated guidelines that have been put forth that I think we can certainly ease up some of the restrictions that we have been following since September when we did resume in-person services. I will pause there to see if there are any questions regarding COVID-19 and building reopen plan.
Questions for Brian? Thanks for the presentation, Brian. Hearing no questions, let's proceed to the next item on the agenda, which is the budget update. Brian, you have the floor.
Thank you. I'm going to split this update between Andrew and myself. On the federal side, as Tyrell had indicated, we did receive the allotment of the Randolph Shepherd Financial Relief and Restoration payments. We received $317,280, and we are in the process of getting the documentation that is required in order to distribute those funds to the operators who had documented losses in calendar year 2020. Under the Deafblind Advisory Committee's approval, we did put forth a budget proposal for how to appropriate among the vendors the funds that we anticipated receiving in the budget that the legislature passed, that Andrew can certainly talk about. And those contracts are actually now in the process of being provided to the various providers for their signature, so we're really pleased that that process moved along fairly rapidly this year. In terms of the vocational rehabilitation program, I have talked about this before. The biggest challenge for the Voc Rehab program has been expending money. Unfortunately, with COVID causing so many of the providers to be either closed completely or offering only virtual services, that come upside of that has come with far less cost associated than in-person services. The Voc Rehab program actually has carryover funds from 2020 that we were only able to allowed to carry forward for 1 year, which means we had those funds available to us through September 30 of this year. But whatever the dollars we are unable to expend will be reverting back to the government. It's over $1 million that we're anticipating will go unspent because of the impact that COVID has had. The National Organization, the Council of State Administrators of Vocational Rehabilitation, has been working to educate members of Congress to this dilemma, particularly members of the Appropriations Committee. And it is possible that the Appropriations Committee may put forth some language that would allow an additional period of carry forward of those funds so that they could remain available. So we're waiting to see what the appropriations budget looks like. Also, I just wanted to talk about a couple things. I had mentioned at the prior meeting of the advisory board that our Voc Rehab program was in negotiations, conversations with some other agencies for the blind across the country to apply for a federal Disability Innovation Fund grant. This is a grant that Rehab Services Administration has made available basically because there was so much money that voc rehab programs were unable to spend and had to revert back from the prior year, that Rehab Services Administration decided to put out opportunities for states to apply for these discretionary funds. So Michigan Blind, the Michigan Services for the Blind, is taking the lead in this grant application that includes the Maine Voc Rehab Blind, New Jersey Voc Rehab Blind, Vermont Voc Rehab Blind, and BASB. We're collectively, as a group, requesting, our application was for about $18 million. So it is a substantial sum of money if we are awarded this consortium grant, which would focus primarily on working with employers to solve some of their accessibility issues, to make jobs more readily available to our clients, and working with our clients to help them gain access to certification and vocational training programs. And we feel by doing this as a multi-state collaborative, since there are so many employers that have a presence in multiple states, that this would be a very effective approach to working with these employers. We do not know yet when Rehab Services Administration will be making decisions about awarding these grants, but we're pleased that we put it in. And then one other item, which is a budget neutral for us announcement, is that I'm very pleased to say that through a collaboration with the Connecticut Department of Transportation, that has been an ongoing effort for over a year now, they have secured some funding to make the IRA, I don't know if many of you may be familiar with IRA, but the IRA navigation system available on a pilot basis to folks that are legally blind in Connecticut. So the way this will be working is that folks who want to be able to more effectively access public transportation will be able to get the IRA software to put on their phones, on their smartphones, and it would be at no cost to them, and they would then participate in a research project through Department of Transportation to let DOT know what their experiences have been, with the goal of improving the transportation, the whole transportation experience for folks that are legally blind in Connecticut. So we're very excited about this collaboration, which again comes at no cost. And there'll be more information forthcoming on that soon. And that, I guess, will allow me to turn it over to Andrew for any updates he has on the state budget. Let's give Andrew a moment to unmute.
I'm unmuting and unfacing. So I'm audible. Tell me if I'm not. A number of bills passed this year. And some that were in the works did not. And of course, the budget passed in the last day. And then they did an implementer bill, actually just yesterday, I guess. The Senate and the House have been meeting in special session, one to work on the implementer bill. As you may recall, that includes a lot of language to flesh out the budget. It also includes a lot of other bills that didn't make it out of session that people put in or sneak in, and that just got passed. Just a sort of a quick overview, ADS is an agency that spends about $104 million, and about $71 million comes from Washington, and the state puts in about $31 million. That doesn't quite add up because there's some other private funds in there, but it's roughly a bit over $100 million, and the federal government puts in about 70%, and the state puts in about 30%. So the state has appropriated about $30,800,000 for the year that just started. Will start in a couple weeks on July 1st, and about $31.5 million for the second year, what they call fiscal year 23 of the biennium. They pass a two-year budget, as you probably all recall. Some features: the line for children's services, educational aid for children who are blind or visually impaired, is in the first year about $4.4 million, and a little over $4.5 million in the second year. Now VR is all merged up, right? Am I right about that, Brian? That is about $7.7 million. Special training for the deafblind stays the same over previous years. Well, I'm sorry, it's been up and down over the years, but right now it's settling at about $240,000, $240,000 for the deafblind grants. Chris Radio, once again, these next 2 years will get a much bigger chunk than they've been getting a few years ago when the legislature was cutting them a lot. They're going to be getting about $70,000, Chris Radio. The legislature added back money to the independent living centers. So instead of the governor's recommendation of $550,000, I'm rounding, there'll be about $765,000 for the five independent living centers. So the state puts out of the general fund about $29 million. But then there's $28.5 million. There's a couple million that comes from workers' compensation for a workers' rehab program, and almost $400,000 for our fall prevention, a program to help senior citizens learn how to avoid falls because they're so damaging. That's almost $400,000. So again, it's about a $31 million amount from the state next year and the year after, with some growth, and about $70 million from the federal government. I did want to point out that the budget calls for, because this may be of interest, moving the Library for the Blind from Rocky Hill to Hartford. And I don't know quite what the geography will be within that building. You may know that the State Library shares that big building across from the Capitol with the Supreme Court. If you walk into that building, the Supreme Court's on your right, the State Library's on your left. Where the Library for the Blind will be, I do not know, and I think I want to thank Steve Thal. He had asked me some questions about it, and I had not known of that change. It doesn't affect our agency. I hadn't known, but that is something that may be of interest to you. And then, lastly, but of course I'll take questions on the budget, lastly, in the implementer bill that just got passed, as I was saying, there's an additional $2 million to our agency for community support for deaf and for blind. I don't know what that is, and I'm going to have to find out. That seems to be a new thing. I do know that there are people in the legislature who have added money to the independent living centers in part so they can hire interpreters for the deaf at each of the centers so that people who are deaf can more readily access services, because for lack of interpreting, as we all know right now, there's an interpreter right now. To give help, but it says $2 million for blind and for deaf. So I don't know what that is. I need to find out. I was at an event yesterday for Chris Radio, and the Senate Chair of the Appropriations Committee, Kathy Austin, was there, and she made reference to this $2 million, and I see it in the implementer bill. It comes from the federal ARPA money, you know, COVID money. It was a little bit of the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in COVID money, a lot of names for a lot of accounts, and they put $2 million into our agency, and we'll need to find out what that is for. Among the bills that got passed, the ADS agency bill passed, and that actually been a bill we tried to pass last year and it died when the legislature closed because of COVID. That really just made some technical changes to how the appointments work on the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Advisory Board. Also in this legislation, in the Deaf and Blind Advisory Board, they included reference specifically to deafblind. I'm sorry, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Advisory Board. I apologize. The Deaf and Hard of Hearing Advisory Board referred to those two groups, deaf and people who are hard of hearing. It will now refer to the deafblind as well. And that was a recommendation that came out of the advisory committee itself. We made some other cleanups to the assistive technology loan program. what the state, what our agency has started doing is not directly lending money, but having people get a bank loan, and we guarantee the bank loan. And so that means a bank is running the loans. They're better at it than we are. It also means someone can build up their credit, but the bank is willing to give the loan because we're guaranteeing it. And we wrote that into the law. And also, and I told you this 8 times probably because this bill's been around for a while, there are different sections of our statutes that allow people to give gifts to the agency. Actually, just recently, we got a very big gift from a former staff member. The legislature combined and said you can make a gift to Aging and Disability Services. And so I apologize, my desk phone is ringing and I don't know how to make it silent without picking it up and confusing the caller. So it'll be over in a second. Another bill that got passed was a mental health bill of rights for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, make it clear that mental health services should be accessible in the ways that are most productive and most accessible to people who are deaf and hard of hearing. There was a bill on service animals to change Connecticut statute wherever it said guide dog, say service animal, copying the federal government. It actually went through almost the whole way and it passed the House, but it didn't pass the Senate. So that bill didn't pass, an act concerning service animals. And that was to try to make everything line up with the federal government, make all our statutes match. And it did refer, service animals means dogs. So it didn't apply to emotional support animals of various kinds. It applied to animals that are trained to perform a function in support of someone with a disability. That did not pass. You might have been watching that. There is a bill that passed creating a workforce development pipeline for persons with disabilities that will be in the office, will be the work of the Office of Workforce Strategy, but we'll be working with them on that topic. A number of senior citizen bills got passed. A lot of nursing home issues came to the fore this year, of course. So issues like allowing people in nursing homes to have access to technology so they can communicate with the outside world. There's also been a push, and I'm afraid I don't know if it passed into law yet this year. I haven't even checked because so many things happened in a confusing way, to allow people to have a camera showing their bed so people can kind